National Gallery Podcast.
Hello, I'm Miranda Hinckley, and this is the National Gallery Podcast in glorious Technicolor.
Catherine's Pear, Carnation, Incarnate, Sanguine, Stammel, Flame, an obvious one, Gingerline, Murray and Peach.
We see shades of Renaissance red with costumier Eileen Shake and artist Al Johnson. Plus,
in fact, the rather nice soft grey colour is actually a result of the pigment change in the paint.
So that's yellow lakes at work.
That's yellow lakes again, yes, that have faded.
The scientific team tell us about a pigment that's notoriously difficult to conserve. We start, though, with white. Phantom is an exhibition of works by the gallery's youngest ever associate artist, Alison Watt. Her paintings are deceptively simple, large-scale images of folded white fabric, which hide as much as they reveal. And as Colin Wiggins found out, even their colour is not as straightforward as it seems.
Alison, we're standing in the Sunday Room now, the day before your exhibition opens, and it's all hanging on the walls, and the pictures are glowing off their grey background. They look very, very white. And I know from seeing you at work in your studio, you use a lot of colours in your picture. Can you talk us through a little bit about why these pictures look white, but they aren't really white?
Well, it's actually quite interesting to see them in these surroundings because they look very different from the way they looked in the studio. And I think the colour, because I'm showing the work almost purely in natural light, I think the colour really comes out. And I had the chance to control the lighting in this space, but I like the idea of allowing the natural light to go up and down because it means that the paintings are constantly changing, so you never have a fixed view of any painting. And if you were to look at my palette in the studio, there's actually about 8 or 9 colours. I mean, I use cadmium red, I use sap green, I use Prussian blue, burnt sienna, so there's actually a lot of colours beneath the use of white paint, so it's actually quite a complicated mix to come to the colour that you're presented with.
In fact, when you look at the paintings in these conditions of light, with the daylight constantly changing, you do begin to pick up on these blues and reds and greens that are in there.
I think you do. I think it's the combination of the grey walls. The grey is a very neutral colour. Chris Oberon, the designer, came to me before the exhibition, and I knew I wanted the walls not to be white, because I thought that would be completely wrong for the paintings. And he gave me about 50 different greys to choose from. And the grey that I finally chose without realising it was Sainsbury Wing Grey. So it's obviously a great colour because it's a very soft grey and it allows paintings to sing out, which I think is really important. It's not at all overbearing. You just become aware of the colour that's going on in the paintings rather than the colour of the wall.
But predominantly, even though we know that these colours I can see from where I am now, I can see a lot of blue in that picture. Mm. And even as you point out, the burnt sienna, that beautiful kind of dark yellowy tone. Mm. But the colours, the pictures are predominantly white. And what is it about white, do you think, that so attracts you?
I mean, I think your eye picks up white as the main colour as a way of simplifying it. I think it's a shorthand. I think you tend to pick up the shapes first and the colour second. I think we have very little memory of colour when we move away from a painting. But I think white paintings, if that's what we choose to call them, I think they allow you to project onto them. I think depending on how you're feeling will depend on how you feel about the painting.
Do you think there's a kind of symbolism in there? I mean, white is traditionally associated with purity and innocence in old master paintings.
I think white is associated with so many things. I mean, it's associated with innocence. It also has religious connotations of the shroud, but there are so many different meanings to white. I think depending on who you are, you will attach a different meaning to that colour, and depending on your background.
People have come into this room, and although, of course, it's unashamedly a secular exhibition, many people have remarked on the fact that they get a sense of the sacred looking at your pictures. Has that surprised you?
Well, there's something I like about the space because it feels quite separate from what's going on outside. You know, you're not aware of... It's a space to be quiet in, and it's a space, I think, to contemplate. So I think that's possibly where the non-secular connotations are coming in. You know, it's a place you actually want to just sit down and be. and think, and that's a, I think that's a good thing for the paintings.
Alison Watt talking to Colin Wiggins. If you'd like to see the paintings for yourself, come along to the gallery. Phantom is free and open until June. And you might also like to know that a special season of films chosen by Alison runs throughout April and May. Highlights include the 50s classic Night of the Hunter, and full details can be found on our website, www.nationalgallery.org.uk. A woman poses for her portrait. She has jewels in her hair and an exquisite satin dress, the striking colour of which will ensure she's still turning heads over four centuries later. We ask costumier Eileen Shake and artist Al Johnson to tell us what's so special about Moroni's Lady in Red.
My name's Eileen Shake and I'm a costumier.
My name's Al Johnson and I'm a sculptor and a lecturer at the National Gallery.
The Moroni portrait of a woman, or a lady in red as she's known, is quite extraordinary because it's an extremely high fashion that she's wearing, and you can really see that from the actual colour that she's wearing, which is a deep rose pink with an underlay skirt of yellow gold and a red shot colour through that gold, and it's probably a woven textile, so it's highly likely to be real gold thread within the underskirt, and also the bodice that is just revealed at her neckline. The colour of the fabric is a pink rose with a gold coming through it. It's the most extraordinary orangey, pinky silk. The colour is probably cochineal because this was a new dye at the time, made out of the bodies of cochineal insects, and was imported from the New World, so from South America, and that was only discovered in the 1540s. So you would have been a very high-standing person to actually wear these kind of pinks and reds.
The material is extremely sumptuous. It's intended to be warm as well as beautiful. The sleeves have got tiny tufts of white silk pulled through. This was, I think, an effort to show that this lady had at least three layers of cloth, all different kinds of cloth, to show her extreme wealth.
In the Renaissance period, you would have been able to have obtained a vast range of fabrics dyed in various shades of red. Different reds produced by the Kermes insect. You get anything from a very vivid dark red, a scarlet or a cardinal red, right the way through to something that's called maiden's blush, which would have been a very pale pink. In between, different names that appear in literature of the period describing reds: Catherine's pear, carnation, incarnate, sanguine, stamel, flame, an obvious one, gingerline, murray and peach. But other colours are also described in the same way. So a very vivid one is goose turd green, which I think we can all imagine what that might look like.
Red is such a heavily symbolic colour. I think that's partly why it interests me. The reference is, of course, to blood, and it's a visceral colour. It's the colour of the internal form of the body. It has references to war and destruction. It's a masculine colour, and in Christian iconography, it's the colour of the crucifixion, of the colour of the martyrs. So there are all these kind of very male, very dominant references to red. But what interests me, I suppose, is its paradoxical nature, that it's also the colour of sexuality, the colour of lipstick and lingerie, and so it's also a female colour.
Dyeing fabric using the Kermes insect or the cochineal insect can be done in various different ways, and actually to produce the different hues that you require, so either the very deep bluish purpley pinks or the really deep reds or the very pale pinks, you might well have started by crushing the insects themselves and crushing the bodies to actually produce a dye in a little bag that you would then put into a dye bath. And dyeing thick satin needed great care and attention to make sure that none of the fabric was exposed to light while it's in the dye bath. The fabric has to be completely submerged all the time to get an even tone. The dye must be perfectly suffuse all the way through the liquid to make sure that there's no patches of darkness or almost a sort of tie-dye effect that can happen if you've got a large amount of fabric in one dye bath. And so these dyers were incredibly experienced, incredibly scientific in the way that they produced their fabrics. And those would have all been in Venice, where still the best silks come out of that area.
I work with paradox in the sculpture I make, because I make work that's very often about ideas that are quite big or quite difficult to encompass. And red I've used extensively because it has this paradoxical nature, and so I feel it reflects the kind of paradox that I'm trying to uncover or explore in a piece of work. I've been working on a series of sculptures about women in the military, the paradox seems to me that we don't regard women as being aggressive or militaristic. So I wanted to try and explore that, so I used red because it has these masculine qualities, but at the same time these feminine sexual qualities. The series of work started by making a series of weapons. I made wooden dummies based on First and Second World War guns and contemporary military issue. And then they were covered initially in red satin. And I felt that the sumptuousness and the sexiness, the sensuality of the satin, undermined the objects, so that you had something which appeared to be a weapon, and yet it was undermined by the material from which it was made.
Eileen Shaikh and Al Johnson talking about a much-loved treasure of the gallery's permanent collection, Moroni's Portrait of a Lady, or Lady in Red. Our final visit this month takes us to the conservation studios in the gallery's attic. Housed beneath a glass ceiling that provides optimal light for their detailed work, the science and conservation teams rescue damaged and deteriorating paintings. As part of that role, they study how colours change over time, including a pigment that, as I found out, is notorious for ageing badly, yellow lakes. I've come up to the conservation studios to have a look at a painting that's being worked on at the moment by Albert Kuip, A Distant View of Dordrecht. It has a view across some fields, and in the foreground are some cows and some milkmaids, and it's quite a lovely rural scene. How long has it been with you now?
I'm not really sure. Probably about getting on to a year, I think, because we work on a variety of different pictures at once, so it's not only that picture. But there was quite an extensive amount of work to do, thinking about what was going on and doing a lot of analytical work together with the scientific department, which kind of helped us proceed. So it was a slow progress, I think, for the cleaning.
And it seems that one of the problems with this painting was, in fact, his use of yellow.
That's correct, yes. All the greens are painted in so-called mixed greens, which means that they've used a yellow pigment mixed with a blue pigment to make the green. And particularly in the darker greens, the artist has used a pigment called yellow lake. And yellow lake is made using a plant dye stuff. The most common one in the 17th century was a plant called weld. But the trouble with plant dye stuffs is that they're very vulnerable to fading, and that's what's happened in this painting. And when we took a sample from the foreground landscape and looked at it in cross-section, perpendicular to the surface of the paint layers, then we could see that the top portion of the paint had faded and turned white, and that has the effect of creating a sort of misty veil over the foreground landscape.
Is this issue with yellow lake a particular feature of Cope's work?
It was a very common way of achieving green in the 17th century, and he's not the only artist whose paintings suffer this type of deterioration, but a lot of artists mixed other pigments in as well, which have meant that their paintings hadn't suffered quite so badly. But it is a very characteristic paint defect for paintings by Cope, that's for sure.
But the overall effect is of this really beautiful kind of mustardy yellow and a very kind of crackly paint surface. What is this actually an image of?
Well, this is a very high magnification detail of the lower right foreground of the painting. And here we can see patches of yellow-brown varnish that are left on the surface of the paint. In fact, the rather nice soft grey colour is actually a result of the pigment change in the paint.
So that's yellow lakes at work.
That's yellow lakes again, yes, that have faded.
So what will be your next step in terms of returning the picture to its former glory?
Well, after the structural treatment is done, repairs to the canvas itself, the picture will be revarnished, and then we'll start to fill in any losses with a filler to bring it up to the same surface level, and then we will do a retouching using not necessarily identical pigments, but certainly the same kind of layer structures. If there's a grey and then a brown and then a translucent yellow, for example, in the original, we would repeat the same kind of structure to get the same optical effects, with the intention of making our retouching as difficult to see as possible. That being said, with the understanding that you can always see it very readily with ultraviolet light, and the fact that we also document anything in every stage of the treatment, so there's no intention to deceive in a fundamental way, but simply to make the picture read as harmoniously as possible when it goes back on the wall.
Thanks to Larry Keith and Marika Spring. That's it for this episode. Don't forget the gallery is free and open from 10 till 6 daily and 10 till 9 on Wednesdays. Join us again next month for all the latest news. Until then, goodbye.